Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At home, at camp, or on the beach, summer is a time for kids to catch up on their reading. From the latest Suzanne Collins or Rick Riordan blockbuster to poetry, pop-up books, ghost stories, nonfiction, and comics, our panel of enthusiasts are ready to give us their picks for their very best choices for kids and maybe their parents, too, this reading season. This hour On Point, Summer Reads for Kids. You can join the conversation. What are you and your kids reading this summer? New picks or old favorites? What's your strategy to keep them reading now that school is out? Joining me now from New York City is Monica Ettinger. She blogs about kids' literature at Educating Alice. She's also a fourth grade teacher at New York City's Dalton School, and she contributes reviews of children's literature to the New York Times. Monica, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also with us from Chicago, Illinois, is Esme Raji Codell. She writes about all aspects of children's literature at her website, planetesme.com. She herself is the author of several books for kids and adults. Her kids' books include Viva la Paris, Diary of a Fairy Godmother, and Hanukkah Schmanukkah. Esme, thank you for being with us.
Hooray! Thanks for having us.
And from Kansas City, we're joined by Pete Cowden. He's owner of the well-loved kids' bookstore Purple Reptile. Under his pen name, A. Bitterman, he has a book coming out in January, Fortune Cookies. It's illustrated by Chris Roschka. Pete, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hey, thanks, Jane. And it's Reading Reptile.
Reptile. Thank you. I'll begin with you, Pete. How's business at Reading Reptile in your bookstore in Kansas City? A lot of excitement for good summer reads?
Yeah, summer's always fun. You know, we've had a hard year. It's been a kind of a bleak time for books, and I think with the economy going down. But we've been hanging tight, and it's always good to come into summer because it is the most fun time to help kids and. And everybody's looking for a good read and something to broaden their horizon.
So, Esme, handicap the summer book scene. Does it look good to you this year?
I think it actually looks wonderful. And Pete's really right. It is a difficult time in the economy, which makes it so important to sift through all the thousands of children's books that are published every year and find the very best books for the children who so deserve them. To this end, I would also suggest going to kidlitosphere.org, where many children's book blogs are featured.
How is the blogosphere? Busy now, Monica?
Oh, yes. I mean, I was just at ALA, and there are new blogs coming up all the time. ALA is the American Library Association convention, but a lot of books, book publishers and bloggers, everybody was there. Lots and lots of bloggers, new ones all the time.
So, Esme, start us out here. Give us your pick for summer reads for kids.
Well, I'd really like to start with The Strange Case of Origami Yoda by Tom Engelberger, because if you have a child going into the sixth grade all the way through sophomore year of high school, you need this book. And if you have a boy in that age group, you need this book yesterday. This book is laid out in short chapters like a collection of scientific evidence to discover whether the goofy origami Yoda puppet that Dwight insists on wearing on his finger is an oracle, and if it's able to give advice on such important middle school matters like what to do when splash water makes it look like you wet yourself or how to talk to a girl. Is this paper Yoda wise or just a wad of green paper? And can I just say, what I really liked about this book, besides it being absolutely hilarious and pitch perfect, is that at the start, Dwight's often called a weirdo, but by the end of the book, the characters sense that isn't very nice and maybe isn't even accurate. Kids who liked Diary of a Wimpy Kid by Jeff Kinney will find what they've been wishing for here, and there are instructions for making your own origami Yoda in the back of the book.
So the strange,
if you do a Yoda imitation, the read aloud is all the better.
Ah, Strange Case of Origami Yoda by Tom Engelberger. Very good. Monica, your pick.
My first pick is actually also a real crowd pleaser. It's Cosmic by Frank Cottrell Boyce. It's the story, it came out a few years ago in England, but I think it's one of these universal stories, a boy who's considered to be a big lad. He's a 12-year-old who looks about 30. He's pushing 30, very tall, is already getting a beard, and he manages to pretend or take advantage of this here and there in a very sweet way, and he ends up winning a contest that sends him and several other so-called dads, he pretends to be a dad of a classmate of his, of a girl, and they go off to China, and they turn out they're going to be going on one pair is going to go on a rocket around the moon. And so it's a very funny, endearing, just a wonderful story, great to read aloud, great for kids to read on their own, boys, girls. I read aloud a couple of years, had kids then go read it on their own.
So read a little bit of it for us.
Okay,
here.
Great. I am not exactly in the Lake District. Mom, Dad, if you're listening, you know I said I was going to the South Lakeland Outdoor Activity Center with the school? To be completely honest, I'm not exactly in the Lake District. To be completely honest, I'm more sort of in space. I'm on this rocket, the infinite possibility. I'm about 200,000 miles above the surface of the Earth. I'm all right-ish. I know I've got some explaining to do. This is me doing it.
There's also a great audiobook I'm seeing here
that
accompanies this.
Yes, it's wonderful.
So Cosmic, Frank Cottrell Boyce. Very good, Monica. Thanks. All right, your turn. Pete Cowden, give us your pick.
Yeah, I'm kind of into the European imports, and Monica just read from something from England. There's a Dutch writer named Toon Teligen, and they've released some of his stories recently, and one that's out right now is called The Squirrel's Birthday and Other Parties. And the sensibility of this book is so amazingly different, really, than American writing, in the sense that it's much more impressionistic, and you find that a lot. I think when you go back also in books, kids' books, you find this a lot, like in the beloved classics, you know, like Winnie the Pooh or things like this. You see books that aren't so much plot driven. They're really more concept driven. Mm-hmm. And in this case, Toon Teligen really nails it. And they're really light and breezy, but they're also very existential books. And in this case, this would be for a 7, 8-year-old, 9-year-old reader.
In fact, it's described as a charming little book, as delicious as a piece of cake, which just happens to be squirrel's favorite food. So read for us from The Squirrel's Birthday and Other Parties.
This is from the very beginning, and it sort of sets the stage, and it kind of gives you an idea of the lyrical quality of it. To make sure that he never forgot anything, the squirrel had pinned little notes on the walls of his house. On one such note was written, "Beech nuts." The squirrel often read that note and said to himself, "Oh yes, beech nuts. I mustn't forget those." Then he turned around, walked over to the cupboard, and soon after, he was eating a plate of beech nuts, sweet or stewed. Another note simply stated, "The ant." When he chanced upon that particular note, the squirrel nodded and thought, "That's true. I really should go and see the ant." Then he slid down the beech trunk and walked over to the ant's house, calling, "Ant! Ant!" along the way. Not long after, they were sitting in the grass on the riverbank, chatting about things you could never forget and never remember. They often sat there for hours. And this whole book is like this. It goes, it's a variety of animals in a very limited setting of a forest, an ocean, and an oak tree, and they all interact, no matter how big or small they are. The elephant dances with the ant. The squirrel, you know, meets the whale. In one point in the back of this book, near the end, a seagull writes a note to a whale that says something to the effect, "If you find this, I'm not sure you really exist, but you're invited to a party." And then the whale gets all excited. And most of the book, all the animals are, it sort of revolves around these different birthday parties. And it's totally charming and lovely. And it's great for that age group, too, because those are the kids who are completely open to things like this. They're not, you know, there's just such a sense of discovery in the books, and it's very, very a good fit for the 6 to 8 year old.
So Toon Teligan, The Squirrel's Birthday and Other Parties. Very good. Monica, tell us about Suzanne Collins and her much anticipated book, Mockingjay. These are so popular right now, aren't they?
Yeah, I put this series in. Certainly people know it in the world, but it is extremely popular, and I think they're great summer reads for kids who haven't read them yet. I mean, it's a trilogy started with The Hunger Games is the first in the trilogy. And basically the situation is you've got a dystopia. It's the ruins of North America. You've got in the center something called the Capitol and around it 12 districts. And every year they have something called the Hunger Games where two tributes, young people from each district, come into sort of an arena and they literally fight to the death on television. And in the first one, we meet Katniss, who's a 16-year-old who takes the place of her sister in the Hunger Games, and she prevails. And it's in the second one is Catching Fire, and I don't like to say too much. More drama ensues. We understand there's more of some rebellion brewing in the districts, and we're anticipating very enthusiastically Mockingjay, which comes out August 24th. And Scholastic, I think, wanting to build on the enthusiasm, has not allowed. They have an embargo. There are no advanced copies available.
Oh, yeah. It's a total lockdown. It's like Harry Potter.
Yeah. It's sort of, I think, same publisher. They're trying to, understandably build enthusiasm for
and
it.
And this series is recommended for what age group?
I'd say, maybe 12 and up. I forget what they say themselves. I've actually had 10-year-olds read it. It depends on the child. I mean, I'm not great on violence and goriness, but I thought it was managed pretty well, remarkably, considering most of the children are killed off in this arena. There are a couple of moments, but it's extremely, she's very deft, very does a very good job at managing this sort of situation in a way that makes it accessible even, I think, for a 12-year-old.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about great books for kids this summer. And you can see lists of the suggested books that we'll be talking about this hour from each of our guests on our website, onpointradio.org. We're joined this hour by Esme Raji-Codell of the website planetesme.com, also by Pete Cowden, owner of the Reading Reptile Bookstore in Kansas City, and by Monica Edinger, fourth grade teacher and blogger at Educating Alice. Pete, can a young child have a valuable reading experience without a book? I mean, how about a magazine or a comic book or the sports page?
How young?
Well, you tell me. My 5-year-old's reading, but I'm not sure,
Well, from my own experience, my guys are avid readers of the comics every morning, and they love it. And, like, my daughter Gloria, who's turning 14, she keeps me updated on Brenda Starr, which is great because then I don't have to read them all. And she can kind of keep me, up to date.
Updated.
You know, it's hard to read 3 frames and then and be vigilant. But anyway, they love that. And I think that's important on a certain level. I think there are a lot of things in that statement you made which are interesting, because I'm torn about that, because on one hand, any kid reading, you hear that a lot. If a kid's reading, that's good. And I kind of don't agree with that. But more on a theoretical level, I think that there are good things to read and bad things to read. And I think identifying that standard, that there is quality in children's literature and in literature in general and anything you read, and understanding the value of things is important, just as important as reading itself. So that's good. As long as you understand what you're reading and kind of where it falls, I think there's a lot of mismarketing that is diminishing kids' abilities to sort of navigate. The Hunger Games is a good example. I think it's well written, but it lands more on the side of a guilty pleasure to me than great literature. And that's no disrespect to the author. I think I had fun reading it by all means, and there are lots of things like that. But I think that's hurt kids' literature over time, that sort of marketing impulse. And I think that's why when you look at European books, there's just a lot more variety and diversity in terms of the quality. But anyway.
So Esme, if there was ever a perfect book for those so-called reluctant readers, I think you have one. Miss Brooks loves books, and I don't.
Oh, yes. Miss Brooks loves books and I don't, by Barbara Botner, is just a must have for every reluctant reader and for every cutie who's embarking on a summer reading program. In it, there's this kind of Gen X-y looking little girl in a knit hat. She doesn't like books about cowboys or fairies or holidays or animals, and she's referred to as stubborn as a wart, but did somebody say warts? Warts are what she's into. This is a really hilarious and honest picture book, and it suggests that with some persistence, there's a book out there for every reader. It's about making the right connections. And I'd really like to comment on the illustrations. They're priceless, especially those showing Miss Brooks pulling out all the stops in order to share her enthusiasm, whether she's dressing as a really very hungry caterpillar or packing her patron's backpack full of about 3,000 books in the hope that she'll find the one that makes all the difference. It's more than a really funny story. It's a celebration of why we need libraries, not just as places where we find books, but places where we find the people who believe in their power. And, you know, could I just comment a little bit on the conversation you were having with Pete, because I think what was really interesting in your question and important is that we really do need to recognize readers of nonfiction as real readers, too. I wish you could see the cover of the book I'm looking at right now with a cheerful little orangutan. He's got his hands on his knees, and he's postured like an old vaudevillian, and it's called Orangutans Are Ticklish, Fun Facts from an Animal Photographer by Steve Grubman. And there's all sorts of familiar wild animals, and they get double-page spreads with a great photo and fun facts. Like, I didn't know that giraffes whistle and moo and hiss and roar, but I think the photos take on special meaning thanks to the backstories. Like, looking at a photo of a tiger feels different once you know it tried to attack the photographer. I think if we recognize that it's not always Alice in Wonderland or The Hunger Games or big, thick novels that make real readers, cookbooks, magazines, comic books, graphic novels, these invite real readers as well. And that isn't to lessen what Pete said. There is quality out there. It's a matter of finding it.
I love some of those facts in there, too. Orangutans are ticklish from the book. If a hippo is yawning, it doesn't mean he's sleepy. It just means he wants to fight.
That's right.
Pete, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I totally agree. I mean, I think nonfiction is sort of suffering right now as far as trying to figure out, you know, what to... I think there's some really great nonfiction books, but combining... And there are kids who only read nonfiction, and there's, like you say, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But I think as far as packaging and creating a nonfiction book, there's a lot of room out there in publishing to really advance that, because there are a lot of readers out there who would prefer to read about real people, real places, real things, real animals. And I think that's, again, you know, being in tune and attuned to what the kids really need and want, rather than what you think they need and want.
Here's a listener from Arlington, Massachusetts, joining us. Julie, hi, welcome.
Hi, Jane, how are you?
Hi, good, go ahead.
I just wanted to recommend a couple of books. The Cricket in Times Square, I think it's George Selden, and The Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler by Konigsberg. They're older books, but they're really great reads.
Are they some of your favorites, and do you read them to your kids?
Yeah, my kids love them, yeah.
Yeah. Great, Julie. Thank you. Monica Ettinger, give us another one of your picks.
Well, I'm glad nonfiction was raised, because my next pick happens to be nonfiction. I think as a teacher, what I see with kids reading, I made this list thinking of books that are going to really, kids of all kinds are going to be engaged in, you know, get engaged and grapple, get into these books. These are all books that I think are very appealing to kids for different reasons. The book I have in mind is Claudette Colvin, Twice Towards Justice by Philip Hoos, and this is a nonfiction book. It's about Claudette Colvin, who in March 1955, she was 15, and she just did not get off the... In Montgomery, Alabama, months before Rosa Parks, she refused to relinquish her seat on a Montgomery City bus, and she was a teenager, and she got herself in all kinds of situations. She was shunned by people, but she was undaunted, and she was involved in a challenge that, again, it was a landmark case that struck down the segregation laws of Montgomery, and she kind of got swept under the carpet of history, so to say. And Phil Hughes worked waited very patiently and was able to interview her. And this book is absolutely phenomenal. It's her voice, her story. He comes in the back, the author, bringing in sort of the images and just information for a young reader to really just be completely swept away by the story.
I
nonfiction,
agree.
Fantastic story.
It's a Monica, wonderful book. Yes, Pete.
Was that the same author who did the Ivory Bill Woodpecker book a few
yes.
years ago?
Yes.
Yeah, that guy's great. Yeah, that's yeah. And that Ivory mm-hmm. Bill Woodpecker book is awesome as well.
Yeah.
He's great.
Such a compelling look at a 14-year-old's point of view of this. Mm-hmm. Of history.
And I should just say she was at the award ceremony just now in D.C., Claudia Colvin. And it was just incredibly moving to see her there and be part of, you know, her story coming back out, you know, being out there.
Really. Again, the name of the book, Claudette Colvin, Twice Towards Justice. Great pick, Monica Ettinger. Thank you. Let's go back to the phones. Augusta, Georgia. Joanne is on the line. Welcome. Hello. You're on Point.
Hi. I just wanted to put in a plug for some really old literature, and one of them is Eugene Field, who I read as a child, and my mother read to me. I've been reading it to my 5-year-old granddaughter, and even though a lot of the language is archaic, it doesn't really matter because for her, all language is new, and so any words are just new words, and she really loves it. And then, of course, my mother and I both were writers, and we would write little stories that would include our children. And so I'm continuing that with her, writing stories about her and her family.
Ah, wonderful. Thank you, Joanne, for calling. I appreciate it. Here's Catherine in Bridgewater, Connecticut. Hi, Catherine. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I first of all just wanted to say hello to Esme and Monica. Esme, I've been reading your blog for about 4 years. It was the first blog I started to read. And through yours, I found so many others, including Monica. So I feel like I'm talking to old friends and just wanted to give their blogs plugs because they really have been so helpful to me. I'm a literacy specialist in a K-8 school, so I have a really wide range of kids to promote reading to. And through both of their blogs, I've been able to find just scores and scores of wonderful books to share with the students that I work with. And I wanted to say thank you to them personally. So I appreciate that.
Oh, that's great, Catherine. As a reading specialist, what did you recommend to some of your kids this summer?
Well, I really recommended sources for their parents to find good books. As Esme said, it's so critical to find books that are just right for that individual reader and not prescribe something to them. It's really, you know, if you you think of books that you yourself have read, if it's not something that's for you and that's the only book you can choose from, then you just don't want to read. So it's really so important to find the book that is what's mm-hmm. right for them. So I gave book lists and, resources for the parents to find what's going to be helpful to their kids. Mm.
Catherine, thanks. And thanks for your work. Pete Cowden, give us another one of your picks, summer reading for kids.
Well, on the topic of poetry, one of my picks was The Dreamer by Pam Munoz-Ryan and Peter Siss. And it's I guess you would call it a middle grade novel. But it's based on the childhood of Pablo Neruda, and it's sort of an imagined childhood, you know, based on readings that Pam did. And one of the really groovy things about it is that it's sort of itself a long poem. It's very, very lyrical that way. And the illustrations that Peter does for it are extraordinary, as usual. But the way that it all fits together, you know, I think that's something I wanted to bring up too a little bit, was when finding a really good book is seeing how it works, you know, together, just with pictures and text. In this case, since they're dealing with one of the greatest poets of the 20th century, they dot the book with his poetry, his actual poetry, and images by Peter. And it's just an extraordinary, extraordinarily sensitive book. And, you know, he was a troubled, sickly, stuttering child with a very evil father. So there's definite conflict there. It's not just sort of a there's lots of things going on underneath, like there would be in a poem. And I think as grown-ups, we appreciate that as well. Like when you read a book, like Winter's Bone by Daniel Woodrell, that's a movie now. That's like a long poem to me. It's just an extraordinary experience. And I think in this case, again, anybody could appreciate this book at any age, quite frankly.
Once again, it's called The Dreamer. Esme, you have a pick in the poetry category. It's called Mirror, Mirror.
Oh, I sure do. I was almost jumping into the phone to talk about this great book. According to this really inventive author, Marilyn Singer, a reverso is a poem that can be read from top to bottom or bottom to top, and the only changes allowed are in punctuation and capitalization. And reversos can be about any topic, but here in this book, Mirror, Mirror, they shift the point of view backwards and forwards in familiar fairy tales like Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, Goldilocks, Rapunzel, Ugly Duckling, Snow White, and all of those guys. They get the up and down treatment to good effect. I'm going to read you one of the introductory poems, if I may.
Yes.
It may be such a fairy tale secret, this much I know. The road leads wherever you need to go. And then the other half of the poem reads, you need to go wherever the road leads. I know this much. A fairy tale secret, it may be such. Now, the cool illustrations, they're cut down the middle to tell two different stories. And besides enjoying the book, young writers are really going to enjoy the challenge of creating their own reversos. So it's such a fresh, fresh poetry pick.
Very good. Thank you very much, Esme. Let's go back to the phones. Christina is on the line from New Milford, Connecticut. Hi, Christina. Glad you called.
Hi there. I'm so glad I got through. Now, I've got a plug for one of Esme's book, and a big hi to Esme, because she's hit me on so many levels as a teacher, as a mom, as a writer myself. Her book, Sahara Special, is my first read aloud every single year when I go back to teaching sixth grade reading, because one, it is an incredible story. It's got a powerful, self-possessed, stubborn as a rock heroine who you just can't help but love. And to a student, every single student, boy, girl, all of them, they become enraptured with this book, with the world of an inner-city Chicago school. And whenever I finish reading, because I only read for about 5-10 minutes at the beginning of the period because our periods are so short, it's, oh, come on, Mrs. Verba, you've got to read some more. And this would make a wonderful, wonderful summer read for moms, dads, kids, anybody. Oh, well, it's a fabulous book.
We'll add it to the list on the website. Christina,
wow, thank you. I'm blushing over here.
Congratulations, Esme. Here's Julie in Rutland, Vermont. Hi, Julie. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hi. I just want to let you know I am a 71-year-old grandmother of 12.
Oh.
And I started most of my grandchildren on their reading with specific books. It was very interesting, the comment about the Hunger Games. One of my grandsons read it and said, oh, you've got to get it for the others. And I didn't read it. Usually I check everything out. And now I hear your guest, expert, saying that the author managed the violence professionally or adeptly. And I'm wondering, had I known there was a yearly thing where children are killed, I'm wondering how we come to accept the norm of managing that kind of violence where kids are murdered, how we accept that as a norm and say it's kind of good reading. I'm really confused.
Julie, thank you. Monica Ettinger.
I'm not sure. First of all, I think it's not a new thing. I think there are always books. You can go all the way back to the Grimm brothers and, you know, fairy tales. There's lots of goriness and grimness in those. I think it's really about the child and what you need to know, that what child can handle. I don't think it's really the, I think the reader, I mean, I think this particular author managed something. So what I was saying is it can, I think younger children than maybe the norm given the topic can handle the story. But I do think, I don't think it's really the place of the author to manage that. And, it's more about the child who can handle it themselves.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about great books for kids to read this summer. We're joined this hour by Pete Cowden, owner of the Reading Reptile Bookstore in Kansas City, also by Monica Ettinger of the kids literature blog Educating Alice, and by Esme Raji Codell of the website planetesme.com. I'm curious what the panel thinks about books on tape. Is this as valuable as actually reading? What do you think, Esme?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. For a lot of children, things are rushed along, and they don't always get a chance to have as much exposure to print as they might benefit from. So a great thing to do is get a book on tape and a copy of the book and allow the child to follow along. There's been a lot of research that suggests this is very, very beneficial. It allows children to hear a lot of the nuances of language, because the one thing we know in a world of educational theory is that read aloud across the grade levels is what achieves the greatest academic gains, which is teacher talk for read a lot and kids will learn a lot. Mm. If I may, I'd really like to address some of that really interesting and important question of the last caller.
Okay, sure.
About violence in children's books.
Yes.
Because that is
me
a really
too.
Difficult thing to navigate.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
And I think, to me, for my criteria for children's books, is if a book helps to build an empathetic imagination, it succeeds. And I think that authors, being human too, can be influenced by media and be influenced by trying to create books that are marketable. But I think there are a lot of stories based in real things. I have a couple on the list, actually. Napi Makes a Village, or Napi Funda un Pueblo, which is told half in Spanish, half in English, a picture book about a Mazateca girl in Oaxaca, Mexico. When the government decides to build a dam, her whole farming family is relocated. And there's another book by the wonderful Mitali Perkins, who runs a great blog, called Fire Escape, but the book is actually called Bamboo People, about a 15-year-old boy who's forced into the military by the Burmese government, and in order to escape to get back to his family and to become a teacher, as his imprisoned father would have wanted, he has to befriend a boy who would otherwise be his enemy. Now, these are very serious themes, but they're dealt with in a way that is recognizable and universal to the child. Napi deals with things like dreams and helping and moving, and Bamboo People deals with school and friendship. So if the children come first and the market doesn't, that's a very telling thing. Mm.
Pete Cowden, how do you see it?
Well, I was just going to jump in initially and say, yeah, I mean, some of the great, like, most charming classics are built on that conflict of death, and one of them being Charlotte's Web. I mean, mm-hmm. the pig's going to die at the end, and that's the whole setup. And again, Esme's absolutely right, the empathy comment I'm totally on board with, because that's what it's about. And in Charlotte's Web, you know, that's the shadow. That's you're constantly – and that's what drives the book in a lot of ways, is a pretty grim pretty grim idea. And there are books, I mean, you can go through and through all these things. And I think The Hunger Games comes up. It's interesting when you're trying to sell it, you know, and you immediately know, like right away, whether a parent's going to get on with it or not. And I think on some level, that book is has succeeded very well, because a lot of grown-ups read it and realize, wow, that was pretty good. That was pretty interesting and provocative. I think it's I think, you know, making three books out of one, I was sort of disappointed by that, because I really wanted that to end and have the closure. And I think that did steal a little of the generosity of that book. But on the other hand, again, these sort of conflicts, the only thing, I mean, I was in a car with a kid recently and we were arguing, and she said, "You guys argue a lot." And I said, "Well, what's the key to a great novel?" And she immediately said, "Conflict." And I said, "So at least we have a great novel going." And, you know, it's an important aspect of all literature. It's an extreme example, but I think you can't just write it off because of the subject matter.
Here's a call from New London, Connecticut. Linda is waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm wondering whether you can recommend any books for urban or minority children, adolescents, that have themes that interest them but are relevant to their experience? And I'll take my question off air.
Linda, thank you. It's a great question. Monica?
Well, I have a book. It is historical fiction by Rita Williams Garcia called One Crazy Summer, and it's about three African-American siblings, girls, summer of 1968, and the girls are sent to California from Brooklyn to stay with their mother, whom they haven't known, really, because she left when the youngest, right after the youngest was born. She's a poet. She's known not to be particularly interested in being a mother. That's all they know from their grandmother. And they meet up with her. She's very strange. She sort of takes them back and pays, basically doesn't want to have anything much to do with them, ships them off to the Black Panther Community Center for their days. And so it's a story that's totally set in Oakland, California, in the time of the Black Panthers. These girls, the siblings, are just wonderful. I think it really, even though it's 1968, I think it's very compelling for all kinds of kids. I read it certainly to my class, but I think it's attractive and appealing, I would think, for all sorts of kids.
Rita Williams Garcia called One Crazy Summer. Monica Ettinger, you are a fourth grade teacher.
Yes.
At one of the most prestigious schools in New York City. I mean, help us understand the achievement gap between economic groups, how disadvantaged kids experience the so-called summer slide because they don't have the same exposure to reading opportunities
in
the summertime.
I think, you know, there's a lot of other competing things for kids besides reading, certainly more and more online and even in achievement or urban or social economic disparity, kids are going to be out there doing lots of different things. I think something I've read lately, and I'm sure your other guests can speak to this more than I can, is one of the most successful things that I think people are coming on board with is actually just buying and giving kids books. You know, there are lots of motivation programs, incentive programs for kids with summer reading, but actually the idea of just giving them books, giving families books so they own their own books seems to be one of the most successful things. My students are incredibly fortunate in that they can get just about all the books they want and they can own books, but for to give children books and have children choose the books they want, I think, is incredibly important.
Esme, what about that summer slide in certain socioeconomic groups?
Well, it's there, and I think it's a call to make sure we support our public libraries because a great book in the hands of a poor child is the same great book in the hands of a rich child, but it does have to get into their hands. There is a correlation, I think it was in a New York Times article recently, between the number of books that are in the home and academic achievement.
That's
so
right.
That is very important to get those books. Again, there's just a few buyers for the major superstores, and that's why some of the books are so heavily marketed. It isn't really enough. I would have to get on board with Pete to just have a lot of books, though that helps. There is a difference between wonderful children's books and sort of mediocre children's books, so I really would advise people to go to indiepound.org, thekidlitosphere.org, and find out if you are having economic troubles and you can only invest in a few books, get in touch with those experts, those independent booksellers, those bloggers, those educators who can help you get the most bang for your buck.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Catherine now from Woodbury, Connecticut. Hi, Catherine. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling about brand new readers, and I'm a grandmother who has a 2-year-old granddaughter who comes over twice a week. And I have books left over from when I was a little girl and books left over when my daughter was a little girl. But I have this series of books that I picked up for my granddaughter called Pinkalicious. And they're so engaging. I mean, my granddaughter is totally taken by them, tries to read them all the time. And I think it's because the illustrations are really powerful and vibrant. And she becomes the little girl in the book, and she wants to read all the words and goes over it with me over and over. So I've just totally been taken by this series of books myself.
Duly noted, Pinkalicious. Thanks to Grandma Catherine. I appreciate your call. Here's Trish from Plymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Trish. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. So glad I got through. I love this topic. I have a 6-year-old boy who is very active, has a great imagination, but he needs to take it easy for about a month this summer due to a health issue. So I'm trying to find books, and I'm more than happy to read to him. He's just going into first grade. But I'm trying to find books that would keep him entertained and keep him from running around too much, because he's got to take it easy.
Let's go back to the panel, Trish. Anybody got a recommendation for a six-year-old?
I would love to mention Here Comes the Garbage Barge by Jonah Winter, with illustrations by Red Nose Studio. This is a picture book, and it's based on a true story that took place in 1987. I don't know if anyone's old enough or remembers this. There was this garbage barge off New York that was going all over the place trying to get rid of its garbage, and it never happened. And Jonah Winter has fictionalized this, and the language is hysterical. The illustrations are phenomenal. It's by somebody who calls himself Red Nose Studio. He's created these dioramas basically out of garbage to illustrate the whole thing, and it would just occur to me that your son would just want to like pore over these pictures and read it and look at it again and again. So that's my thinking, suggestion to you.
Here Comes the Garbage Barge. All right, Monica, thank you. Here's Lois in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Hi, Lois. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
It's wonderful to talk to y'all. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
When I was a kid, and this was the 60s, my dad read the little house books to us, and that just like opened up a whole world for us. I remember too reading then on my own a series of books called The Boxcar Children. I can't remember much, you know, who wrote it or anything like that, but it was a really good series of books. It was several children, a family of children who had been orphaned and somehow wound up living in a boxcar and, you know, cooking and just taking care of themselves. And then they get taken in by someone, and at the end of the story, in one of them, the person who had taken them in had brought them their boxcar. Mm-hmm. And it was just a cool series of books.
The Boxcar Children. We've got it, Lois. Thank you. Pete, I've got to squeeze one in here for my soon-to-be kindergartner, Sitting in My Box by Dee Lilligard. Looks great.
Yeah, that's actually a reissue. It was put up by Marshall Cavendish. It was originally published in, I think, 89. But it's a great, very, very simple book about a kid in his box, and he's joined through the course of it by several animals who get larger and larger. And it's sort of an archetype in kids' literature. And then at the end, you know, the thing that breaks the back is the flea jumps in and all the animals, you know, vacate, and the kid's left alone in the box. It's just me in my box. And I love the illustrations by John Agee. I think he's one of the great picture bookmakers, and I'm glad to see this book back in print. And it's great for like 2 to 3, 4-year-old. Also, another good book on that same level is It's a Secret by John Birmingham. That's on my list as well. And I love John Birmingham. He's really getting up there in years, and he's truly one of the greatest living picture bookmakers today. And I have a little – I really am fond of this book because it also does things that a lot of books don't anymore, the books that are maybe trying too hard to create a sassy character. In this case, a girl finds is really curious about what cats do at night, and she comes downstairs one evening and sees this cat standing there in a Three Musketeers outfit ready to go outside, and she's like So anyway, I could read something from that if you want. That's kind of where...
You know what? I have a caller here. We'll put that on our website. I'm going to...
Okay, yeah, no, that's fine.
Just take Bridge, because he's calling from Greensboro, Vermont, and I want to get him on. Bridge, go ahead. Welcome. Hi.
Hi, Jane. I have been reading the Percy Jackson series.
Okay. And how are you liking it?
They're my favorite books I've ever read, actually.
Yeah? Why? Why do you like them so much, Bridge? And how old are you?
I'm 12 years old, and I think they're cool because there's the gods, and I've always liked sci-fi, but this is sort of like it.
Mm. Well, I'm glad you called, and keep reading. Percy Jackson, we love that book. Speaking of Monica Ettinger, Rick Riordan has a new one, The Red Pyramid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Hey, can I suggest another mythology book for that listener?
Okay, go ahead.
We have Encyclopedia Mythologica, Gods and Heroes Pop-Up by the pop-up experts Matthew Reinhardt and Robert Sabuda. If you like the Percy Jackson series, you can really think out of the box with these pop-ups, which are fine for older kids, too.
Mm. Esme, thank you. Monica.
Yes. Rick has a new series out called Beginning, it's the Kane Chronicles, and it's beginning with the Red Pyramid. And for kids who've enjoyed the Percy Jackson series, this one has an Egyptian cosmology going on, two siblings telling their story. It's a dual narrative. And it's got the same wit. It's enjoyable. It's a fun read. Lots of action. Not the goriness of the Hunger Games. Very accessible. The kids I've known who enjoyed Percy Jackson seem to be equally happy with this first in the new series.
All right, last round. Okay, Pete, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say I have one for Bridge. If he's into sci-fi, he should check out one of the books on my list called The True Meaning of Schmeckte. By Adam Rex. It's an excellent and undervalued novel. It's not brand new, but it's awesome, and I think Bridge would dig it quite a bit. It's about an alien invasion after it's happened.
All right, let's go around the table in our last 20 seconds here. A final pick. Esma, you first.
Well, to address all the callers who brought up their favorite classics, first of all, Gertrude Chandler Warner wrote The Boxcar Children. So that listener should check them all out again. But check out Otis by Lauren Long, which is an homage to Ferdinand the Bull.
Esme Rajay-Codel, thank you so much. Monica Ettinger, your last pick?
Yeah, my last pick is a graphic novel, Into the Volcano by Don Wood. Lots of action, very dramatic, all about volcanoes, lava. Very exciting book.
Great picks, Monica Ettinger. Thank you so much. And Pete Cowden, your last pick.
Oh, you know, I'll throw out Arthur Giesert's Country Road ABC. It's a really fabulous book for young readers or soon-to-be readers.
And have a great weekend. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.